Welcome, listeners, to the third season of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and your podcast host. Tune in and join me as I chat with authors writing cozy and traditional mysteries. You won't find explicit violence, sex, or gore. You will find intricate plots, engaging characters, and brilliant writing. Thanks for listening. Welcome, listeners, to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host of the podcast. Lynn Truss, author of the Constable Twitten Mysteries, joins me in the corner today to chat about her latest, Murder by Milk Bottle. Welcome, Lynn.
Oh, it's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, Murder by Milk Bottle is your third Constable Twitten mystery. Would you tell us about the constable and his colleagues and what they're up to?
Okay, yeah. The series is set in Brighton on the south coast of England in 1957. Very specific date, and I sort of researched that date very thoroughly. And there are four main characters, really. It did come out of a radio comedy that I wrote about them all. But I felt as though I'd never developed and delved them as much as I wanted to. So when it came to the idea of writing books, I was very excited. So Constable Twitten himself is 22. He's extremely bright. He knows a lot of long words and he knows a lot of deep concepts, but he's slightly on the scale, I think, really. He's slightly on the, what do they call it?
Asperger's or autistic spectrum disorder?
Yeah, the spectrum. He's slightly on the spectrum, sorry. And anyway, he's come fresh and very keen into the police. He works for Inspector Steen, who has been one of these people who just is very lucky in life, always gets a lot of glory for not doing very much and is actually not very bright, but is very much in charge at the police station. And there's Sergeant Brunswick, who is slightly defeated by life. He's only in his late 30s, but he had a war career. He's now back in Brighton. And although he loves the idea of catching criminals, his main thing he wants to do is to go undercover amongst them and fool them, which never works. And of course, they always see straight through him. And he usually gets shot in the leg as whenever he sort of hopes to expose some plot. He often gets shot in the leg. And then they have their station charlady, Mrs. Groynes, who is a sort of cockney character, as you might find in a film, but at the same time is a criminal mastermind. He's actually running a great deal of the crime in Brighton from the police station. So the sort of interaction between all the characters is quite fruitful, I think. So that's as you say, this was the third one.
Now, you mentioned that the date was very significant. Can you talk about the significance of it, or would that give anything away?
Well, 1957, I sort of honed in on that, and I'm not quite sure why. I was born in 55, so I'm quite elderly. And 57, I don't remember exactly, but I do remember, I suppose, the late 50s in general. And it just seems to me like a sort of very good date in that it's, you know, quite significantly after the war. It's, you know, there's no sign of the 60s. It's a time when actually, for working class people in Britain, it was actually a very good time. There was massive, you know, it was total employment. There were holidays. People went to the seaside as in family groups. There was a sort of joy, I think, in the 50s. And, you know, when I was growing up, we thought of the 50s as rather bleak, black and white sort of period. But actually, you know, when you look at it, it's actually a very colourful time with a lot of enjoyment of life. And I think that's what I like to have as the background to the books, is to have this sort of seaside place that is a bit, you know, you do have a lot of crime going on in the background. It's quite tawdry. But at the same time, there is, you know, pleasure seeking going on. And that's a sort of rather nice background to have. And I love the language of that period. So it's very, you know, it's great to research. films and radio and all that to home in on those, on the sort of language of that time. So, and for this book, say, I spent a lot of time going through archives and newspapers for actual stories of things that were happening around a bank holiday, a sort of national holiday at the beginning of August. And I did incorporate things that I found. You know, there were stories that I found that were in the newspapers. So I thought, well, yes, this is, that gives me a plot, that gives me something. And at the same time, I know, it doesn't matter to anyone else, but I know that it's actually linked exactly to that time. So I really like that. And I'm moving the stories on. You know, you'll know all about this writing a series, that you do have to make a decision about how much you will allow time to pass between each story. Because in my case, I know that the relative ages of the characters, the fact that Twitten is very young, I can't move them forward a year at a time, because he will get to be, you know, 28 in no time. And a 28-year-old who's always saying, "But sir," you know, trying to get his voice heard, would be a bit creepy. You know, it's better that he stays quite young. So I'm moving everything forward a month at a time. So so that there's enough time for the last case to sort of settle and for them to have the energy to deal with the next one. But their basic relationships to each other and their ages and so on stays more or less the same.
You know, what challenges did you face trying to make life in the 1950s seaside town relatable to modern audiences? Or did you not worry about that and just write the story and figure modern readers would understand?
I don't know if I did make it very relatable. I think there would be a certain element of, you know, people having to make a bit of a leap to, as they would if they were seeing an old film or something, and there would be words they don't quite recognise or whatever. I want it to seem authentic. I want it to have, I don't allow much, you know, really modern phraseology, but in my part, obviously, as the author, my narration is very direct to the reader. So I think that, I don't think the reader should feel in any way excluded, because I'm writing it, you know, straight into the reader's mind. You know, I don't want them to be any problem. But in terms of the mores of the time, I think you have to be consistent with them, and allow people to be slightly surprised, you know, that, oh yes, of course, in those days they wouldn't know about this. It's such a lovely thing to set something at a time that isn't today, because especially crime, as we know, crime now is so technological. You know, the solving of crime in TV things is all about, you know, tracking people's phones and their phone calls and so on. Well, you know, you can't do that in 1957. And so quite often they're stymied by the simplest things, because they, you know, they haven't been into the office for a bit and the phone's been ringing and nobody's answered it. You know, that's the sort of, in a comic crime novel, you can, you know, of that period, you can get away with that. So I really like that. I think it gives you a lot of freedom from the point of view of plot. And things don't have to be related to, I assume that the reader is a modern person who is going to think, oh, well, that's different, or I remember when it was like that, or I like to imagine a time before everyone had a mobile phone. So I think it's a pleasure and a privilege to write something that's set in a different period.
And something else that's slightly different is your protagonist, Twitten, is a constable. Now, People like me who kind of feast on BritBox and Acorn are used to detective inspectors and detective chief inspectors taking the lead.
Yes.
But your inspector is actually, to steal a word from Katrina McPherson, kind of a numpty. So why did you choose to make your hero, and I'm making air quotes when I say lowly, a lowly constable?
Oh, well, it's just lovely, because no one's listening to him, you know. So he's not always right, to be honest, to be frank. He's just the cleverest person generally in the room. So it's very nice to identify with him and to know how he is thinking about things. But of course, the order of intelligence really goes up from the inspector. He's the sort of really the stupidest person in the room. Then the sergeant is sort of a bit more clever about crime. Twitten is really clever, but in an intellectual kind of way. And the person who really understands everything that's going on and is a super, super brain is the char lady. So it is a completely reverse of their status. So it goes in complete reverse order to their status is who's the cleverest. And I find that quite delightful. And actually you do find that a lot in comic, in many comic sort of classics, like we have Dad's Army or something. You know, the person in charge is often, you know, he has loads of arrogance and possibly a class advantage. Steen sounds quite posh, but at the same time really doesn't know what's going on. And I think that's quite commonplace really in comedy, but as you say, not in crime, not so much perhaps in crime fiction. So that's rather lovely to have. In all the books, I think so far, Twitten has come closest to sorting things out, but there are always key moments when he talks to Mrs. Groynes, and Mrs. Groynes says, but look at the method, look at the way this person was killed. That would, you know, that person might have a motive, he might be very clever and work that out, but that sort of person would not commit that kind of crime in that way. Because she knows, because she is that, you know, she is a criminal, and she knows. So it's rather lovely in a way that he's not omniscient. He's just as intellectually precocious. In the book I've just written, which doesn't come out till next year, his research. He's been doing some research, and it all comes out. You know, it's all shown. It all goes into the plot in a way, but he, no one wants to listen to him at all because they all find him so tedious. He's always trying to educate them. He's always saying, this is interesting, sir. And at that point they always switch off. So that of course is probably quite a British thing. People never want to listen to bright people. And I bet, you know, if one wanted to go deeply psychological about it, I'm sure it goes back to my childhood of being someone who was always saying, oh, this is interesting. And they were wanting, no one wanted me to talk about it.
I think that happens in America too. I can think of several people that are always kind of showing how smart they are, and you really just kind of want to push them down a flight of stairs, which you don't do because that would be the jail, but think about it.
The thing to do with him though is to keep him endearing, which I really hope I've done with Twitten. I think he's flawed enough and he suffers enough really that I think we can identify with him and care about him. I know my editor loves Twitten, you know, she's like, oh, good for Twitten. we sort of care about him.
I'll confess, Mrs. Groynes is my favourite character.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm very glad.
Speaking of Twitten and Groynes, you do have a very quirky bunch of characters, and you put them in some very comic situations. So is it fair to describe Murder by Milk Bottle and the other books in the series as farce or satire?
Yeah, well, not satire really, I don't think, but definitely farce, yes. There's a farcical structure. Sometimes people ask me to talk about writing, and I realise after a while that what I'm describing really is farce, because I always say, you know, everything you, you know, the way I write these books is often just at the first two, three or four chapters are pure invention, you know, coming up with more and more and more hairs, you know, setting various hairs running, with the intention of gradually folding all these sort of different strands together until you reach a dramatic and funny, hopefully, conclusion. And that isn't how all books are. isn't how all books are written. Not even crime novels. But it's become my methodology, and it's become something I love to see in other people's work and on television and so on. That you know that every single strand of this is there for a reason. And I often, as I start writing, I don't know what the reason is, and I enjoy not knowing what the reason is, but I will make a good reason for it by the end and bring everything together. But that really is a definition of farce. And so I think it has to be said they are farcical. There is always a pretty big climax with everything coming together and, you know, a riot or something. You know, something quite big happens towards the end that brings every strand together. So yeah, I would definitely accept farce as a description.
And I have to ask, where did the name Peregrine Wilberforce come from?
I don't know. Well, Peregrine is such a it's a very unusual name. I mean, and is it? I'm not sure if it's P.G. Woodhouse's first name. Is it? Is it Peregrine? I'm not sure now. Mm. Now I say it, perhaps it isn't. But anyway, Peregrine is just sort of very, very posh name. And Wilberforce, I just thought it shows that his parents are, you know, are sort of have no history, and are, you know, I don't know, have sort of nice values. So they've given him that name. There's no family connection to Wilberforce, I don't think. But I just like people to have slightly comic but significant sort of surname to middle names. But no one, only one person ever calls him Peregrine. Everyone else calls him Twitten. Twitten, incidentally, is the word for, in Brighton, when I started the whole thing, I used Brighton-centric names. So there is a steam in Brighton's, the centre of Brighton, by the pier, is a form, what do you call it, a sort of a topological place called the steam. And it was probably the stone or something years ago. And it's just so people who live in Brighton will say, well, I'll see you at the steam. Brunswick comes from the fact that the House of Hanover, you know, is a sort of thing in the history of Brighton, that the Prince Regent built the pavilion, and Carolina Brunswick was a Hanoverian consort. And so lots of Brunswick names around. And Twitten is an alleyway. It's the local name for an alley in Sussex. They around the country, they all have different names. But if you had an alley by the church, it would be the church. Twitten is the is that. And groins, of course, you know, are in the sea and are very treacherous. So you do have signs saying, beware of the groins. So that's why Mrs. Groins got her name.
And how did you settle on milk bottles as a murder weapon?
Well, this was in the research last year, in the papers. I just was starting to get quite fascinated by the amount of milk marketing that was going on in 1957. There was a famous slogan in Britain that was coined in 1957, which was drink a pint of milk a day. And it was drink a pint of milk a day. And it was very modern and striking, and it really caught on, and it ran for years, drink a pint of milk a day. It was but when I started, I couldn't help noticing there were all these beauty contests that were connected to dairy, you know, the dairy industry. There were, there had been a dairy festival in Brighton with floats that went on for miles, and cows, and loads, and milk marketing was this massive thing that was going on. And there was someone called the Milk Girl. There was someone who was called the Milk Girl, who I think people did know her real name, but she was known as the Milk Girl. And she was on posters, she was on TV, on advertisements, and she would go and open things, open milk bars, open beauty contests and so on. So it all started to come together that milk was a bit of, was definitely going to become a theme. So I didn't know, I think as I started, that I was going to have people kill with milk bottles, but it happened, as you know, in the first chapter. So it quickly came upon me that was what was going to happen, that someone was going to be killed with milk bottles, and it would be, the murder would in some way be connected to milk and this enormous amount of milk marketing that was going on. So it's sort of, you know, it was a natural progression from all the reading. It was very satisfying. It's very nice when that sort of thing all comes together.
Yes, it's a very unique murder weapon. I mean, I think that's a regular midsummer murders worthy murder weapon.
It is, but I've no idea if it would work. Of course, I haven't tested it. I haven't tried to kill someone with a milk bottle. Yeah, you know, I've fallen down on the job there by not trying it out.
But to switch up just a little bit, you also wrote Eat, Shoots, and Leaves, which was the book that made punctuation cool again. So I had experience of writing a nonfiction grammar book compared to that of writing farcical mystery fiction?
Well, in the writing of it, I think I really enjoyed writing each season. It was such at the time. Of course, we had no notion that it would be a bestseller, or indeed would sell any copies at all. And it was a very modest little book for a very modest publisher for a modest amount of money, and I had a very short amount of time to write it, actually. So I went at it with enormous gusto and really, really just sort of dived into it, read lots, spent day and night just going through books, looking for examples, trawling the internet, looking for things, and writing with enormous amounts of enthusiasm. And I think the tone of the book, you know, is quite similar, actually, to the crime novels. I think there's the same amount of enjoyment that comes across. The experience of publishing it was so extraordinary. I mean, it was so out of the blue that it caught on so, and that people loved it so much. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful thing to happen. From my point of view, I'd written about many subjects in my life, and I'd also always preferred to write fiction. So there was a danger, a very serious danger at some point, that I could be, that's all I would ever be ever do. You know, it'll always be all I'd ever be known for, but it would, at one point, it looked like it would be all I'd ever do. And I didn't want that. So I sort of pulled out, really. I could have written more books on language or grammar, but I'm not actually, you see, a grammarian. I said so in the book. I'm not, I've never studied it. I have just been a journalist and done a lot of proofreading, and I was interested in punctuation, and I loved finding out, learning about it. And I loved giving examples and showing how, you know, you could mispunctuate something in order and end up with nonsense or something misleading. That was fun, and I really enjoyed it. But I knew that if I carried on writing in that vein, then people would start saying, well, who are you? You really don't know anything about this. So it wasn't a career I wanted. I didn't want to be that. And to be honest, you know, the success of it was such a boon in my life that I thought, well, now I don't have to write this, because, you know, this will make me comfy enough for the next few years, and I can go back to writing the sort of things I want to write. So actually what I really wanted to write at that time was a book about sport, because I had this strange period writing about sport for the Times newspaper in London. They'd asked me to do it when I didn't know anything about sport, and it had been a sort of comic gift, really, that I could go to sporting events and write my own thing about them. And I did that for about 4 years. And so after each Utes and Leaves, what I really wanted to do was write about my experiences and what I had learned, you know, about sport in the course of doing that job. And that, of course, sold sort of virtually nothing, and my publisher didn't even want to do it. And but I'm really glad I wrote it. I think it was something that was necessary for me to do. And that was my last non-fiction book, really. And since then, I've been writing novels again. And so it was great to have success. It was a wonderful thing to be so successful. But it's also quite surreal, because you find yourself in situations that you just think, oh, to laugh, you know, that I shouldn't be here. I remember, you know, the first time I went to New York with Eat, Shoot, and Leaves, the first day I went on the Today Show, you know, and you know, going into this studio in Rockefeller Plaza, you know, and then when I went back to talk again, you know, the next time I went there, Katie Couric said, oh, hi, Lynn. This is so mad. But you know, it was fun. It was fun that it happened, but I just had to keep my feet on the ground. I had to keep saying, this isn't normal. This isn't what's going to happen for the rest of your life. You know, this is just now, and it's lovely, but don't read too much into it. So it was an interesting time. But now, with the States, you know, I mean, I love I had a wonderful time going around the States. I think I did three tours, you know, going to these wonderful bookshops around the States. Well, that's lovely, you know, and I'm always saying, oh, I've been there, you know, when they come up on TV or on news or something. Oh, I went there. I had a marvellous event there. You know, people were lovely. So I did enjoy that. But it was, as you probably know, I mean, it really is very strenuous doing all that as well. It takes it out of you. And now I sit at home a lot more. I'm at home a lot with my lovely dogs, and I just write my books. And I honestly, that's I'm very happy about that. I think that's more what I've always wanted to do.
You also mentioned that you wrote radio comedies, radio plays.
Yeah,
what's that like?
It's lovely. It's a great thing writing. I've never written television, and I don't know whether I'd. I don't know if I'd like the world of it, you know, and how you know, I don't know. I've never done it, but radio is sort of, it's so much smaller, you know, in every way. And it's absolutely lovely to write, because if you want people to read your, when you're reading you, they want, I like the idea that people can hear your words in their heads, really. I know some people read without hearing words, but I don't. I'm a very audio sort of person, or oral, you know. So when I'm reading, I do hear the rhythms, and I hear the sounds of the words and the shapes of the words and the rhythms. And I really, so when you write for radio, that comes very high on the list, really, is how to write dialogue and stuff that with the right sort of rhythms and so on. So and then you turn it over to actors and a director and so on, and the. So for the Steen series that we did years ago, I mean, I knew those actors terribly well by the end, and you just know what you can write that they will do well and what they'll enjoy doing. That was lovely. And I've also written quite a few stories now that I wrote for myself to read on BBC Radio 4. And they're going to come out as an audiobook next year, actually, which I'm very pleased about, because I wrote those for me to read, and knowing my own limitations, you know, in that I can't read dialogue not very well or not very convincingly, I like a long sentence that has a sort of pathetic sort of ending or whatever, you know, those sorts of things, knowing your own style. So that was really lovely. I do love working for radio, but it's sort of the business of getting things commissioned is very Byzantine and stupid, and you have to put forward an idea through somebody, and they put it forward for somebody else, and then they might come back to you and ask for something else, and then they might say, oh, we've got rather a lot about that at the moment, so no. And it's quite unsatisfying. There's no sense. You can't have a career in radio at all, because it's every idea is judged against things that you have no control over. So you can't, you know, great experienced writers, great experienced radio makers are always starting from square one every time they put something in. And that's just demoralizing after a bit. So I've sort of stopped recently. If someone came to me and asked me to do something, I might do it, but I don't want to generate ideas and you know, as I say, you don't have any control over what will be accepted. With those stories, they did come to me and they asked me to write 10 stories as a block to do week after week. And I thought, well, that's hard. Actually coming up with 10 separate short stories set in the same place. And I invented the place and I invented the people. And I did find 10 themes that I really wanted to write stories. You know, these are like 12 minutes or something, so again you have to choose a subject that is that will be, you can deal with satisfactorily in that time. So it was generally, as most short stories are, a moment of revelation or a moment of clarity, something like that, in someone's life. And then you know, we recorded all of those, and then they said, well, another 10 would be nice for the following year. And oh my Lord. So in the end, I did write 26 of these short stories, but you know, and then they said, we'll have another 10. And at that point I thought, well, no, I don't think I can do that again. I just can't do that again. It was an extraordinary amount of brain involved in doing it. But it was very flattering that they did ask for them. But so it was months of work and of course the pay was appalling. But there we are. That's you know, we are used to that.
Yes.
Well, we're very lucky to have it here. I mean, in the States, you don't have so much, you know, radio drama, do you? You don't have the, you know, the sort of, you know, the BBC is takes care of that sort of thing, you know, speech radio with stories and stuff to a degree. And that is very lovely to have it there. And I would miss it terribly not to have it.
The closest thing we have is podcasts. There are some people creating dramas for podcasts.
Well, that's great.
But yeah, they're not on the radio really at all.
No, but podcasts would be perfect for it. I've always wondered why, you know, audiobooks do terribly well, don't they? Because people have such long journeys, and listening to a book is a wonderful way of passing the time, I think. And radio drama, similarly, you know, is a lovely way to travel. My favourite thing is ever if someone has said, I was driving somewhere and I was listening to one of you. I had wrote some monologues years ago that were for individual actors to do half-hour monologues. We had fantastic people. We had, really good actors do them. And, you know, if anyone said, oh, I was driving somewhere and I arrived before it finished, so I sat outside to listen to the end of, you know, and that's sort of the highest tribute you can get, really, if somebody sort of didn't think, oh, well, that was quite good, and then just get out of the car. They actually sort of bothered to listen to the end. That's very nice.
Now, how does the approach to writing a story that's meant to be read aloud and heard by someone differ from the approach to writing something that's meant to be read on a page or a screen?
That's a really good question. I think it's really important as well that you do think about what the listener experience is, because there is a, you know, there are some things that are put on the radio are not suitable. They're not suitable because they are too writerly in some way. You know, they rely a lot on, you know, involved imagery or something. I think you do have to think about it being quite a direct medium. And so I think about it quite a lot. And also, you know, sound, sound being an important part of it, the way that you want to, the cadences of sentences and so on should vary and so on. So yeah, it's more like music, really. You're thinking about it musically as well. And I used to teach a course with someone with radio, and what we used to start with was an exercise, which actually I think people took it, you know, didn't quite understand the point of this, so perhaps it wasn't a clever exercise after all. But we will put people in pairs and say, well, here's a feature of this house that we're all in. One person write a description of it, and one person stand in front of it and describe it to the microphone. And of course, well, the writerly one could be as brilliant as anything, but it is never as good. It's never as interesting to the listener as the person standing in front of the, you know, the picture and describing it, even if they were doing it quite poorly. And there's something, you know, that was a sort of lesson in what radio is about, really, in that it comes from the person. It doesn't come from the words. It's in the tone of voice. It's in the intention. It's in the immediacy of it. And so I think that's sort of, so you do have to think about it quite differently. And as I say, you know, from my point of view, not having so much dialogue, because when I read dialogue, I don't really do it very well. So even when I wrote it, I would then rewrite to get rid of as much dialogue as possible and put it all into indirect speech, so that I could, you know, put over the sense, but without embodying a character, because I'm not an actor and I couldn't do it. But it's a really good question. I don't think I do know the actual answer, but I know what I like. And I think that we learn from doing it. But I do think that it is to do with that. The fact that you haven't got to overcome any barriers. You know, the word on the page there is a bit of a barrier. You know, the person has to put some effort into reading. They don't have to put any effort into listening.
They sort of have to put their earphones in or headphones on or...
it's there. It's in your head. You know, you don't have to, you know, sort of, you know, if you worry about missing anything or having to go back to read it again or anything. It all goes in. So it's a great, I think doing what you're doing is absolutely lovely. I mean, I think it's so, oh, sorry, that's my dog. A bit of immediacy you didn't need there with the dog. You know, it's a really good thing, I think, doing podcasts.
Are your stories available on BBC 4 now? Because I think you can actually stream that in the US.
I don't think they are at the moment. They did repeat some not that long ago, which might mean they might be on something called Sounds, BBC Sounds. I don't know if they're available abroad. I don't know. You know, sometimes they block people listening outside. But they certainly will be in the new year, which is quite a long way off, but in 2021. They're going to be on Audible and, you know, various platforms as an audio file. So they will come out, and they were caught. The place that I set them was on the south coast of England, a little bit along from Brighton, not far, and it's where the meridian goes through. It starts at Greenwich, you know, the Greenwich Mean Time. Is where time begins, you know, is at Greenwich. So, and the Greenwich Meridian leaves the British coast at a place called Peacehaven. So I set the stories there and I called the place Meridian Cliffs. And the series was called Life at Absolute Zero, because zero is what the degrees are there, you know, the longitudinal degrees is zero at this point. So that's what it will be called.
And while we're waiting for 2021 for the audible version of short stories, in the meantime, we can read about the Constable Twitman Company, because that'll be on sale from November 10th.
I think so. Yes, I'm very pleased. It's out in the UK, you know, comes out earlier in the UK. November, yeah, in the US, and I'm very pleased. It's, you know, they're lovely. The people I deal with in New York with Bloomsbury are absolutely super, and they've been very, very kind and very enthusiastic about the books. So, because it takes a while for a series to get going, I suppose. I mean, some people, you know, I'm sure have a great success with the first one or something. I'm definitely building up with these. I think that. You know, getting reviews and getting a sort of head of steam or whatever is something I'm quite interested in. It seems slow to me because I'm a bit impatient by nature and I'd like it all to be happening already. But, you know, I've just written the fourth book. It'll come out next year. And, you know, you just have that sort of sense of continuity, which is really lovely. And just gradually hope to build up more readers who enjoy them. So it'll be lovely to get this third one published, because I think in a way it sort of lifts off with the third one.
Does the fourth book have a title yet?
Yes, it's called See the Bunny Run, and which is there's a character who is a sort of street character who works for Mrs. Goines, and he stands with he's a sort of peddler, and he stands with his tray of little clockwork rabbits. And he says to people, see the bunny run, see the bunny run, see the bunny jump, only half a crown. And he is standing, you know, doing his cockney patter with these bunnies. And his disappearance is the beginning of the book. He disappears. So it's called See the Bunny Run.
Now, of course, I have an image in my head of the Energizer bunny murdering someone.
I'm glad you didn't say that when I was writing the book, because obviously that could have been, you know, the way it went. But luckily I've already finished, so I won't incorporate that now. But yeah, exactly.
And where can readers connect with you or find out more about you? Do you have a website, or are you on social media?
I don't really do social media, no, but I have got a website. I should update it more often. I don't think it's even got the new book up yet, but it's called lintrust.com, and there are some columns and various things on it. But I do have also a newsletter, which I do. So people can sign up to a newsletter, and then I do, you know, when there's something coming up, I will write to people and say, which is, I think, just nice. You get sort of nice feedback from that. It is so lovely that, you know, I mean, I used to be a journalist, and I was, you know, I had a lot of contact with readers. As a novelist, much less so, you know, you don't know much. But while I was writing the fourth book, I wrote, you know, sometimes I'll tell you something about, it's very funny, about the murder by milk bottle, actually. That would be a good one. I was doing a talk, and the book wasn't finished. In fact, I just started, really, and I had various themes about milk in my head. You know, I knew that was all happening, and I had this one little detail from the papers that I'd been thought, I must get this in, I just like it. And it was this little story about just before the bank holiday in August 1957, a road sign outside Eastbourne actually had been turned on the road, so that people going to Eastbourne would go off down a side road, and it ended at a sort of village pond or something. And it was just a funny little story, and they didn't have the conclusion to it. But I thought, I really must get this into a story. So when I was talking to this audience about my process, I just said, well, I'm going to use this thing, you know, and I don't know how, really. I just want to bring it in. And as you know, it comes in very early in the book, and it's where someone is murdered at the crossroads, sort of thing. But I told them this story about the, you know, the sign that had been turned, and there was a general laugh, and it was nice. And then afterwards, a woman came up to me and said, "You know that story you told about about the sign, the road sign? That was me," she said, and that was in 1957. So she was about 10 years older than me. And she said she and her friends had turned this road sign, and they got into lots of trouble, and it had been in the papers. And you know, that is just gorgeous, isn't it? I mean, I just think absolutely lovely. And when you do have contact with, you know, I mean, people give you so much back, you know. And I wrote a column in a sort of paper that's given away in a supermarket recently. It's a very, very good supermarket, does a very good paper. And I wrote about, in the fourth book, I have this system in shops, you know, in old-fashioned shops. They had these cash delivery systems that would be, instead of, you know, everyone having a till in each department where they took the money and so on, they would put the money into a canister and shoot it across the room to, an, you know, to a someone behind a screen, you know, who was the cashier. Or they put money in the canisters and put them in tubes in the wall, and they were sucked away to the tube room where the cashiers would, you know, take the money, put the change in, stamp the sale note, send it back in another tube. And so I was writing about how I was researching that, and I got a wonderful letter from an old lady who said, I worked in a shop in Liverpool, and, you know, it was my job to post these tubes back, these canisters back up the tubes. And that's just lovely. You know, there's nothing nicer than thinking you've had that contact with someone, and it's been so creative, you know, it's lovely. Anyway, so luckily 1957 is within living memory for some people. So it's very nice to get that. She also said she worked in the mantle department, and which was coats and dresses. And I've never heard that expression before, ever, the mantle department. So I was able to put that in, you know, with an explanation, with people say, what's that, in the book, because it's such a nice detail, you know, from that time.
Yes. Well, I think dresses were called mantle. I went on a tour of Colonial Williamsburg, and so talk about all the old terms for dresses, and I think someone did mention that.
Did they? Yeah, well, very interesting.
But I didn't realize that they kept that all the way into the 1950s.
Yeah, yes, yeah. No, it's lovely. So I do love that. So if I did social media, that might happen more, I suppose. But I'm quite shy of it, and I don't actually want to spend the time on it. That's the quite selfish with my time, and I know I would just get sucked in and never see daylight again. So I don't dare get involved. I'm a bit obsessive by nature. I mustn't do it.
No, we would much rather have you writing radio stories and books and stuff in the Twitter hole. So,
how are you getting on? I mean, I'd love to know how you're getting on.
Actually, I'm doing pretty well. I am trying to limit my social media time because it is dangerous. You can up in 2 hours have passed and you're like, gee, how'd that happen? So I'm trying to balance podcasting and writing and social media and my day job. So it's a bit of a juggling act. But
it's a lot to do, a day job. Because how many, there are a few books now, aren't there?
The fifth one came out this past March.
Great. Well, that's really good. That's really good. Well done. Well done. That's really something. I'm just banging. Do you have any intention of writing full time, or do you want to carry on with the, sort of doing both?
Both. I actually like my day job. It also pays well, but I actually like it on top of that. So I'm a civil servant. It's funny to say that civil service pays well, but I'm also a physician. So that's I'm meeting some interesting things. Like I'm here in Newport at the Naval War College because of my day job. So that's an opportunity I wouldn't have gotten without the job. It's actually kind of exciting. So I'm not ready to retire from that yet.
No, well, you're young. When I look back at things I used to do, I can't believe how much I used to squeeze in. You know, deadlines, 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 writing a book, you know, deadline, 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 writing a book. I had so much on, and I suppose, you know, yes, now I am so content just sort of to be working on one thing at a time, really. I can't believe how much I used to squeeze in.
Although 26 stories plus novels doesn't sound like one thing at a time.
No, that was actually all overlapping. That's quite true. That was all overlapping. No, that's true. And recording them was hilarious. We were doing it through a local production company in Brighton that has a very sort of rather dilapidated property, really. And I'm sort of sitting there, and you could, if it was raining, you know, water would be sort of dripping to the studio, making a sort of noise. And we'd have to sort of cut around that, or sort of someone came in and put a bucket under it. You know, it's just sort of, it wasn't glamorous. And quite often, actually, my producer, who is British and lives in Wales, she would be actually in California in the winter. So we would have to record a time of day when we were both awake, which would be her first thing in the morning and my sort of, and before, you know, everyone went home here. So it would be 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, when actually, you know, you're quite tired. So I'd have to, and I always have a cough. Whenever anything important comes up, I develop a cough. So, it was funny. It was hilarious. But anyway, lovely as well. Sorry about that. That's my dog.
All right. What kind of dog?
I've got two Norfolk Terriers, and they're gorgeous. And I'm just about, my dogs don't know this yet, I'm about to get a third. I'm going to get a puppy quite soon, which will cause such a lot of outrage, I'm sure, in this house. But I'm very excited about her. I think she's going to be gorgeous. But it'll be quite a big thing.
A lot more barking.
Yeah, there'll be a lot more barking. Yes, I know. Oh, dear. But anyway, it's very nice.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Lynn. And thank your dogs for joining us too.
They won't be left out. Oh, sorry. But thank you very much. It's been very, very nice to talk to you. Thank you. And thank you to your listeners as well for listening.
Yes. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to my chat with Lynn Truss, author of Murder by Milk Bottle, available November 10th in the U.S. You've been listening to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks, listeners, for joining me for another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star rating or review wherever you listened. Follow the podcast on social media. I'm on Facebook as The Cozy Corner Podcast and Twitter and Instagram as podcast_cozy. Now you can support me on Patreon. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month and get a shout out on an episode of The Cozy Corner. Support at higher levels gains access to patron-only posts, thank you gifts, and giveaways. Sign up at www.patreon.com/authoralexiagordon. Thank you for your support, and thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.